Thank you. And of course, I'd like to thank Tony and the rest of the organizers for inviting me to beautiful Santa Barbara. And I couldn't help but showing a photo from another part of the US where I did my postdoc with Ken Schaefer from Louisiana. So it's his backyard, not mine. Not his. I should probably change it to Sweden. I'm back in Lund University where I work with Anne-Louis, but I made a small detour to Louisiana. Okay, before I introduce my outline, I just want to make a statement regarding the previous talk. You don't need few cycle phase stabilized lasers in order to do attosecond physics. That's a common misconception, which is completely wrong, and it has driven many people out of this field, and I think it's just bad to say such things. I think many of you agree you could do beautiful. you could do a lot of attosecond physics without phase stabilized few second pulses, and I hope I can show you that, because we don't have phase stabilized few second pulses. Instead, we work with something called attosecond pulse trains, short APTs, and they're usually okay.
So how do you reconcile your statement with this morning statement that you actually need it? Is that you need it for this polarization gating?
For the polarization gate, you need, when you need few cycle phase stabilized pulses, is if you want to generate a single attosecond pulse, then you need maybe not a few cycle pulse, but you need a phase stabilization. When you work with trains or when you work with the electrons coming back, you don't need that. And you have plenty of time. A half an IR cycle is 1.3 femtosecond. And if you haven't done your measurement in that time, it's not out of physics anymore. That's another statement. okay, so I'm an experimentalist.
See, Ken has schooled you.
it was always this way.
Okay, I'm an experimentalist, and as Tony said before, it's our job to tell you guys what we can do. And my plan here is mainly to focus on the first part. This is a new source. This is a new type of attosecond pulses. They come in two flavors so far. We have single attosecond pulses. We have attosecond pulse train, where the pulses are separated by half the driving cycle. I will show you that using two colored source, we can get one pulse per IR cycle, and we end up in a regime in between the two commonly known generation schemes. And I should say it complements the other. Of course, it's nice with single attosecond pulses for some applications. Of course, it's nice with the train with one pulse per half cycle for some application, but this one complements. This is a new tool or toy, which way you like it. And you can also use these to actually produce phase stabilized few cycle XUV pulses if you want to do that. Towards the end of my talk, I will use these pulses and show you how you can use them to actually control the three-dimensional motion of electron wave packets. And briefly towards the end, I mean, it was a nice lunch, I tried to keep this short, comment on the question raised by Anne last week that in this new field, we ionize with an XUV pulse, we drive it within an IR field. What is a strong IR field? When can we call it a strong IR field? So I will give my view on this question. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the group I've been working with, many other groups, but what I present now, mainly these groups. The group in Lund with the three PhD students, Per Johnson, Thomas Remeter, and Eric Gustafsson, a postdoc, Thierry, and head of the group, Anne-Louis, who was here last week for the conference. At Louisiana State University with Matt the Guardian, Ken Schaefer, and also the group in Amsterdam with Mark Racking and Frank Lapine, who actually helped us build some of the detection devices which we're using frequently nowadays. Okay, I'm an experimentalist. This is the experimental setup. I won't really go into details. The take-home message here is that we have a setup which is rather flexible. We use the pump probe scheme like usual, and we can independently vary these two arms. We can play with them. I will introduce second color in the pump arm later. We can rotate the polarization, we can change the intensities, and of course, most important, we can change the delay between the two with very high precision, a couple of tenths of attosecond. This will be a problem if you go to shorter pulses, because so far we translate time into length measurement, and with a couple of attoseconds that's okay. If you go down to septosecond, I don't know how you would measure the bed precision, but that's a later problem.
Experimental question over here. How do you keep human milk here from oxidizing?
They do. They do oxidize. We produce them ourselves. We try as quickly as possible to take them from one vacuum chamber into the other. They are freestanding, so we just catch them on a small hole. But they do oxidize. That's a problem.
Another question.
Sure.
Do you stabilize the arm length of the interferometer?
Yes, or not active. It's passive stabilized. We try to bolt everything as hard as we can to the table. Everything is built in the same optical table.
What is the RMS deviation?
I don't really know. It's at least within small fraction of an IR cycle or a half cycle. I mean, we it's good enough to do these measurements. We do see the oscillation in rabbit signals, for instance, clearly. So it's with very good contrast. So we're confident in that it's stable enough. I don't know the exact value. Just one slide from Anne's talk last week to show you how we can do it. We have this aluminum filter and the aperture. These are really the multitaskers in this setup. They do everything for us. The aluminum filter removes the IR, it removes the low order harmonics, it compresses the harmonic into nice attosecond pulses. The aperture is what Bandrock keep telling us about that we shouldn't use, because it removes the second trajectory or contributions from the second trajectory. But we haven't figured out any better way to clean it up, so we use the first trajectory. And with this scheme, we've been able to generate pulses as short as 170 attosecond. Actually, been shorter lately. It's important here, it's that these pulses, that the energy we use, they are actually 1.2 cycles. So they are short. It starts to be important to talk about not just the envelope of these pulses, just like visible pulses, but also talk about what is the absolute phase of these pulses. You're all familiar with this analogy, the load lock femtosecond laser analogy with the pulse train. We have this cartoon Ken showed us, and even on the blackboard, even in theories can draw this cartoon on the blackboard. Well, we select a part of the plateau, and if they are synchronized, well, we get the train of attosecond pulses. There is another figure you're all familiar with when it comes to mode-locked lasers, and it's the Nobel Prize from last year, when they use the frequency comb, and then they can, through just a Fourier transform between energy and time, you get the relation between the mode position of the comb and the not the absolute phase, but the phase slip from pulse to pulse in your pulse train coming out of the laser. And it's a really simple formula. You measure how much are the modes offset from some gauge determined by the mode spacing, and you get your phase slip. Of course, and these modes are really close, so I mean, what was difficult with the lasers was really to measure this accurately and find ways to do that. With the harmonics, it's not very hard, because the harmonics are spaced a couple of EVs. So in the case of odd harmonics, the spacing is about 3 electron volts. And really, the accuracy we need to measure these things is on the order of this spacing. So it's not too hard technical problem. The spacing is 2 omega, as we all know, so we use the 2 omega gauge. And then we just measure what is the offset of the harmonics compared to this gauge, and it turns out, of course, they are odd harmonics. It's just half the separation, and this is an equation even an experimentalist can use to just plug in the numbers, and you see that automatically it comes out you have a pi phase shift from pulse to pulse in your attosecond pulse train, and of course the spacing is also half the period of the driving field. You could, of course, go the other way around and say that, of course, we have an attosecond pulse train with a pi phase flip from pulse to pulse, and that's why we have the odd harmonics. And I mean, either way works. It's just that the harmonics were discovered so much earlier than the attosecond pulses that tradition says that you should talk about harmonics, but sometimes it's easier to think about it in the time domain. Okay, so what can we do now? If we want to stabilize this phase or make sure that the phase is the same from pulse to pulse, that's what I mean with it, stabilize it. Well, we could always shift our comb just by the offset, but that would produce just the even harmonics, and then we would get the same phase from pulse to pulse, but I don't know how to produce just the even harmonics. If someone knows that, that's good. What we do know how to produce is both odd and even harmonics. And all of a sudden we just change the gauge, we have an omega gauge, and now we're on the mark. Of course, since we changed the number of frequency components, we also changed the spacing between the pulses. But they will have the same phase, and they will now be separated by one optical cycle of the driving field.
What did you change to get even
harmonics? I'll tell you. We have a knob to do that. No, the two-color field. I'll come to that. That's the okay.
So I'm confused about two different ways that phase is important in your experiments. This is one, and you really explained this beautifully, so I'm actually not confused about this.
Okay.
Now I'm confused about the other one, which is the phase that needs to be controlled in order to compress your pulses down to this 1.2 cycle.
Okay.
In other words, the phase shift between, now I'm in the frequency domain again, I'm thinking about the phase shift between neighboring harmonics and the train that you use rather to measure and
yes.
aluminum filters to control.
Yes.
So my question is, if you have such a phase slip, then how does that affect this picture?
It will affect the picture that if you have a phase slip, you will get a variation. Actually, if you have a linear, if you have a chirp on your attosecond pulses, the absolute phase will change parabolically over your attosecond pulse train.
Yeah.
So the phase will slowly change across the pulse.
And what does that mean to the appearance here on this one omega gauge and so forth? Because see, here you make this really beautiful connection between the offset of a harmonic from zero on
yeah.
the gauge.
What's missing
and the phase slip from pulse
yeah.
to pulse. So
what's missing in that is that these pulses actually have a bandwidth.
Yeah.
And that bandwidth is what comes into account. In the case of the frequency comb, they have the train they're using is very long, so the comb the teeth in the comb are very narrow. And they don't really bother about the width. Whereas here, this will come into account because we won't have an infinitely long pulse train. It will be a train with an envelope. And that envelope gives you the bandwidth of the individual harmonics. So frequency variations within the bandwidth will be phase variation.
I don't think I'm not satisfied by that answer. I'm not going to hold you up here because you're going to talk about it.
I'm not going to talk a lot about this.
And you're going to talk about something pretty interesting, which is with your subject, so I won't hold you up on it, but I have to get this sorted out because I don't think you answered my question, really.
Okay.
Actually, maybe I can just ask a little around it. It's known that during a rising part of the pulse, then the frequencies are offset from the harmonic
number. Yes.
You can zoom around and things like that. So in that case, I guess you don't carry on both. If that is, doesn't project back to zero.
Sure. If you have a very short pulse, then one trajectory in the next, there will be a big variation. I mean, that's... Yeah, and that's... I mean, looking at Ferenc Krauss' experiments, for instance, when they use a few cycle pulse, they have... It's short enough so that you generate two attosecond pulses. And playing with the carry envelope phase, the harmonics move around. Okay, he won't call them harmonics because they move around. But it's really just the same thing. The field is different from two consecutive half cycles. That will affect the phase of the attosecond pulse, and you get the shift between them.
But even then, I think it was first looked at by Margaret Henry 15 years
yes.
ago. And then it's a much longer pulse, but you
yes.
still see that shift.
Yes, but then you include ionization, right, so you don't have the later part. This all needs, you don't want to saturate the process. This is just for theorists to know that it's doable. I mean, we have some handles, and of course the pi phase shift is the most important flip. Then there will be small corrections. working in the cutoff region, these corrections are not as severe. It's really very stable what we see from. Well, we haven't been able to measure this. I mean, we can't measure absolute phase in the extreme ultraviolet yet. That's another challenge for this group, maybe. Okay, so how, back to your question, how do we do this? We want to break the symmetry. We want to break the inversion symmetry of the process. And we do that by adding the second harmonic to the driving field. So we have a strong infrared laser, we frequency double part of it, we mix the two, and we get the two-color field. And for the IR field, ionization at consecutive half cycle leads to the same trajectories. Okay, they will be inverse due to the antisymmetry of the field, but that's the only thing. Whereas with the two-color field, if we ionized here, the electron will move in this field, and ionized here, it will move in this field, and the two cases are very different. And this was realized early up in the early 90s, that adding the second harmonic, you could actually generate both odd and even harmonics. So, been well known for a while, but it's only been talked about in the frequency domain that it's a nice tool to get.
The Kim group is perpendicular.
Yes.
IR and blue. That
yes.
Makes a difference, isn't it?
I think it makes a difference.
Perry also used perpendicular.
Perry, they used both. I mean, I think Kim, they also tried it both. We've only used the parallel. Okay, so let's just look at this, how it might look, and start with the classical trajectories you all know how to calculate. So depending on trying to get the feel for what we could expect, for some phase difference between the red field and the blue field, we get two different trajectories, one with the low energy and one with the rather high energy. The blue lines are time spent in the continuum. If we change the phase between these two, we can really play around. We see that for some delays, or some phases, we get the same cutoff energy, but they are no longer, consecutive pulses are not evenly spaced. There is still this 1 omega periodicity overall structure. What we can't say from this is what is the probability for these different, not from the classical calculation, we need to go a step further. Otherwise, it's tempting to say that, okay, we can just select this upper part of the energy region and we will generate only one attosecond pulse per cycle. This was proposed by a group not too far from here, but I will show you why we choose another way to go. Because we, instead of trying to calculate ionization rates, we do SFA calculations that are corrected for. This is not my work, it's Mette and Ken who's done a lot of work on this. And we do find that for this phase, the latest one I showed, the phase difference at pi 2, we do get, okay, I should say that we can separate here. So the contribution depends on if the field, electric field during ionization is positive or it's negative, just to see the different contributions to the process. So the red is when the electric field is positive, the blue is when it's negative. And in this case, they get the same cutoff, and they have about the same strength. And in the time domain, we see we get two pulses per IR cycle, but they are offset, they're not equally spaced. When we change to the other delay, where we had two different cutoffs, we see something interesting here. We see that the low cutoff is way more efficient than the high energy cutoff, three or four orders of magnitude difference in efficiency. So of course we could select this part, but they will be rather weak photons, whereas here we have a lot of energy concentrated into the main pulse. And I'm happy with that contrast. Three orders of magnitude contrast is good enough for me.
So how come you said approximately zero? I mean, what was the phase angle for this?
It's not really zero. There is an offset. I don't remember the exact value for this one. It's, read the paper. It's slightly bigger. Of course, I mean, we don't expect us to be exactly on the classical predictions, because it's, after all, it is quantum mechanics. It is argon, especially, where the classical picture doesn't hold very well. So there are small shifts, but overall, it's rather stable. The relative in this one is rather strong. Here, what I'm showing is the blue is almost half as strong as the red. An experiment is slightly less, but we just exaggerate to really see these two plateaus and the two cutoffs to distinguish between the two. So we want to know if this is a stable process that we could really use in an experiment. So we do the calculations over all kinds of phase angles, and here might be an answer to your question. We find that for some phases, the harmonic yield and the cutoff position, they are both approximately the same for both possible, both the red and the blue, whereas for a large area, we only have the harmonic yield for one of them dominates completely over the other. So we get a large contribution from one, but not the other. So it should be rather insensitive to the relative phase between the fields. So it should be possible to do this experiment. So let's move on to what it looks like experimentally. So here comes the flexibility of the setup. We take this beam splitter and build a rather complicated beam splitter. It's a two-color Michelson interferometer. We separate the pulse into three pulses, one red, one blue, and a third pulse, which is red, which we later use to probe the other second pulses to measure the duration of them. This is just a lot of detail. The important thing is that they have the same polarization. The energy of the IR pump is quite a lot more than the blue, but we still have a significant fraction of blue in the process. So it's not just a small perturbation. I guess we'll hear Paul talk about what happens if you add a small fraction of blue tomorrow. And we need quite a lot of energy in the probe, as I will show you later. Okay, so when we generate harmonics with only the red pulse, we do see this is now photoelectron spectrum. We measure photoelectrons all the time, so we look at our harmonic spectrum as photoelectron peaks, but it's only the odd harmonics. Adding the blue to the generation process, we see that we start to get both odd and even harmonics, but they don't have the same strength, especially not out here in the cutoff region. So we tweak the delay, the phase between the two, and we show that we could get the very nice, smooth, apart from the spiky structure, the smooth overall structure, which we think should be transform of this with very nice attosecond second pulses. So how do we do then to measure the time structure? Well, usually we measure the time structure with the technique called RABBIT. We look at interference and sidebands in between the harmonics. That we can't really do in this case. We would need, because we need half the frequency, and it turns out to be a tough problem to get phase-locked half-frequency photons. It's not doable. So instead, what we do is what they do for a single attosecond pulse. We use the attosecond streak camera. We take advantage of the fact that if we launch an electron into the laser field, into a dressed continuum, it depends, the energy acquired depends on the timing between the laser field and the ionization event. So for some delays, we get a certain spectrum. Other delays, we get a boost of energy. We transfer a lot of momentum to the electron, and we get high energy electrons. So we could look at this streaking as a function of time delay between the attosecond pulse string and the third pulse, the probe. When we do this with a train with one pulse per half cycle, we see the streaking occurring twice per cycle. And then we do the same thing with the train generated from the red and the blue field, and we see that one of these peaks disappears. We get a beautiful streaking trace with a periodicity of one per cycle. So it's rather clear evidence that we do generate only one pulse per IR cycle, since the dressing field is the same as the IR field used for the generation. But we want to compare different relative phases, and One way to do it is we take the high energy part of the spectrum, or the spectrogram, I should say. We take the part where there are no electrons when there is no dressing field. And we look at the line out, we just integrate. And from the previous slide, we get these occurrences once per IR cycle. And we do a comparison between different cases. We compare, this is what it looks like with only the IR field. We have the modulation, the half cycle periodicity with the field. We get the one cycle, pulse per cycle. And we actually, it's really hard. These results we get for most delays. To get the balance, as you saw in the theory plot, where the two cutoffs actually are the same, where they do overlap, and we get more than one pulse per cycle, and that's the hard thing to do. But there is a small evidence of an additional structure at this point. So this was all published recently. And the next part would be how can we use these pulses to start to do things? This was more about generation, but what can we do with them? To do that, we need a good camera. I mean, the name of the game here is to make movies. That's what everyone talks about. We want to make movies. We want to take a movie of a moving electron. And if we want to do that, we need the good camera. And we use the so-called velocity map imaging spectrometer. This is the one we built in collaboration with Mark Racking. And this is actually what it looks like in the lab. Okay, the exposure time is a lot, but you do see this beautiful structure. This is now ATI in argon. But this is what you see on screen, and you can tweak your parameters and you actually see this move around. It's a wonderful device. I really like it. I could recommend anyone go down in the lab to look at these things. It's beautiful. You finally see the structure, the angular structure of the emitted electrons. Okay, more artistic view of this. We ionize some gas. We usually use argon or helium. We have an electric field and we extract the electrons and we slam them onto a microchannel plate, which is connected to a phosphor screen, which is what you see. So we get the 2D projection of the three-dimensional distribution. And then there is all fancy tricks, but it's basically just an inverse orbital transform, and you get the reconstructed cut through the three-dimensional distribution. Just a small detour. This is calculation again. What it looks like in helium, we have the momentum in y space and x space, and we have the angle in between. Of course, we get the beautiful P wave. And the polarization direction now is vertical. We heard a lot about the street camera yesterday. I just want to show my take on it, what it looks like. This is the street camera ID with a single attosecond pulse with no chirp. You see this, you just move the momentum distribution up and down in the field when you add momentum to it from the vector potential of the field. And I don't really agree with what Paul said, that it's difficult to measure transform limited pulses, but hard to measure chirp pulses, because if...
Oh, no, I meant the other way around.
You meant the other way around. Yeah, because
you get a lot of time.
But the transform limited pulses are rather easy to measure. I mean, you have a lot of information in this, especially when you have this 2D cut. You compare up and down, and if they are the same, it's a transform limited pulse. What happens when you put the chirp on it? It gets asymmetric. The beauty of this is that you have all the information in one figure. If you know the time delay, and that you find out by changing the delay, but if you know the time delay, then you know where you are with respect to the field, and you can tell from the difference up and down, you can tell what the chirp is. So this is a neat thing with this device. It's
so this is assuming you have a single attosecond pulse.
Yes.
And it's only produced once.
And
I'm just trying to think about how this gets modified if you have the usual attosecond pulse train with two pulses per cycle.
Okay, you will see. You will see. This is just, it's easier to explain with the single attosecond. I mean, there are advantages with single attosecond pulses. I admit they are more intuitive. So what does these images look like in the experiment? I mean, the real pictures. So this is now what it looks like. This is just harmonic generation, no dressing field. So this is ionizing argon in this case. So we have electrons everywhere, a bit less on the sides. From only the blue field, we only get one harmonic. But as any baker would tell you, I mean, if you add two things, you get, I don't know how you say this, something greater than the ingoing components. You get this strain with both odd and even harmonics. And of course, this is what we want to put in the dressing field now. So this is it again. This is only the harmonics. We have one pulse per half cycle, and they're spaced by 2 omega. We have one pulse per cycle, and they're spaced by omega. And we have the dressing field.
Sorry, in the picture before, there seems to be some kind of regular substructure on the rings.
There shouldn't be. That must be artificial, yeah. There shouldn't be any regulars. It's about how long you acquire and how many electrons you have. When you only have the harmonics, you can acquire for quite some time and get, I mean, I think they're quite nice figures. Okay. Okay, so let's add the IR field. So this is what Anne talked about last week. One of the electrons ionized different times with respect to the field will be driven either upwards or downwards. And when we do this, we can actually get overlap regions between electrons initially moving in the upward direction and in the downward direction, and that way I get phase information. So this is why, I mean, of course it's important with trains with one pulse per half cycle, whereas the case with one pulse per cycle, we only, in this case, we only drive things upwards.
So, wait a second. So, now I'm really confused. So, three slides back, when there was only a single attosecond pulse, but everything else was exactly the same.
Yeah.
You had symmetric up and down.
Yes.
It was just displaced from zero, but it was symmetric. That is, there was as much going up as down.
Yeah.
Now, what's different now?
More or less the same amount is going up and down in this one. The calculation was made, it's easier when you're way above threshold. The potential is here. Of course, we get a small amount of direct ATI in this case as well.
So what that should look like, except for the fact that it's got this fine structure of the radio rings, but it should look like just the dark thing should be in the middle should be displaced from zero because of where your pulse train was with respect to the
right? Yes, we don't detect, I mean,
right, and is, there it, is it displaced from zero now, or is it placed at the symmetric point?
It's displaced. I'll show you more.
This is electric field or electric field?
This is electric field.
But then it should be displaced if this is a,
yes, yes. When the electric field, when the electric field is zero, then you get the maximum. Pardon?
The right hand situation should be,
yes, yes, yes. But there is this additional structure. Just it's just simple interference between the consecutive wave packets. And of course, we can move this. Now it should be symmetric. Now it's around the center. This one as well. There is additional structure in this one due to the phase accumulated between from pulse to pulse, but the phase accumulated from pulse to pulse in this case adds up to zero. You integrate the vector potential over one cycle and it's zero.
So the, between those two pictures, one of them should, they both should have an equal amount of electron current above and below the nodal plane, but the nodal plane should be shifted up in the previous picture from where it is here.
Yeah, you still have zero energy at one point, so you will actually eventually, increasing the field, it will turn electrons around. But we would like to do that, but yeah, we get a lot of ATI when we boost the intensity up. So I will show you calculations later on. That's, as you say, when you can't do the experiment, do the calculation instead. Moves down and back again. And of course, I like this one because you could actually show this as a movie of the streaking moving up and down. And it's kind of important because this motion, I mean, this is what is the base of almost all the attosecond experiments that have been done, but it has not yet been measured. So as an experimentalist, of course, we would like, I mean, we have this nice prediction that everything should move up and down like this, but it's really nice to be able to show that it does that. It moves up and down.
So if the train were not only there, but chirped,
okay.
then
it is
the
true.
Intensity would be changing in addition to having the hemispheres move, they would also be changing intensity, right?
Yes. And there is a small variation. You'll see that easier from the next slide.
So when Crookes traces out the field, he's basically doing the same thing.
Yes. Well, he's selecting as a fraction of this image.
Yeah.
I mean, this image is the whole story. He's only selecting
one direction.
As I said before, I mean, having both directions adds information. You can actually have single shot measurement and tell you something about the measurement. So now I've just made a line out. I select the central portion where you have most of the information about the duration, and I plot this as a function of time. So this is the electron going upwards, this is the electron going downwards. What you see here is that it looks a bit more narrow here, it's a bit broader on this side, whereas downwards it's the other way around, it's just the opposite. Here it's broader on this side and a bit more narrow here. And this is due to the chirp of the pulse we're using. They're not perfectly transform limited, but it's a really sensitive method. This is within 15% of the transform limit needs to correct to account for this variation. So it's a really neat, sensitive way of measuring it. And I should say the transform limit of these pulses are about 300 at a second, which is like rather not very broad spectrum.
What atom is your photocathode?
Pardon?
What atom are you using for a photocathode?
It's atom. Argon, sorry, argon.
And what density? What kind of jet?
I don't. It's an atomic beam in the velocity imaging spectrometer. It's not a very high density. I don't really know that. I can look it up, but I don't have it. They tend to get rather low. The density in these the beam. Yeah,
and you want the electrons, so you don't want to do it too fast. That's what I was asking.
Okay. So now let's just wrap this up with a question Anne raised last week. Start with one slide. I mean, this is a new way of generating the wave packet in a strong field. Usually you've done with the tunneling, we get the wave packet in the field. Now instead we can use a nanosecond pulse, a pulse train or a train with one pulse per cycle, and select when do we want to initiate this wave packet into the field. Since the tunneling wave packet, they're all kind of similar. You could argue about this, but most of the tunneling wave packet look more or less the same. They're born near the peak of the IR cycle. They are outside the potential well. They have no velocity. And the properties are mainly determined by the IR intensity. They're determined by other things as well, but mainly by the IR intensity. If we use an attosecond pulse train to initiate, and this is locked in phase with the field, so I mean, this is, it's a nice thing. We can tailor the initial duration and initial energy just the way we tailor the properties of the attosecond pulses. The initial velocity is almost never zero. Ionization is a linear process. It remembers where it came from. And we can, of course, choose the time of ionization.
Why do you say the temporal width depends on the intensity?
Doesn't it, for the tunneling wave packet?
The higher the intensity, the more the barrier goes down. Yeah. And then the more time over which it can come.
You change other properties as well, but you change the width by playing with that. Okay, so but Anne raised the question last week. What? Okay, in this regime, what is a strong IR field? When you dress the continuum, what is the strong field? So my take on that is, okay, we can write down the velocity of the electron, and you rewrite it a little bit. Turns out you get the rather nice compact equation, where this gamma twiddle is proportional to square root of the initial energy of the kinetic energy of the electron divided by 2 times UP. And you all recognize the shape of this and what it looks like. It's not a Kellish parameter, but it's a parameter that relates the energy of the electron with the IR field. And what it says is, if this parameter is 1, well then for some initial phases, the IR field is strong enough to drive the electron back to zero drift velocity, that is to drive it back to the core where it has possibility to interact. So I think that's one way to define what is a strong field in this regime. Of course you do this over again, yeah, train. To show some more evidence that this is a good parameter, this is the experiment we argon, but at a higher intensity, and it's now calculated. So it's one pulse per cycle, and this is the delay where we drive part of the wave packet back to zero drift velocity. And we clearly see these jets coming out on both sides, which I interpret as, I mean, they have scattered from the core somehow. Of course, theory, you can always, it's argon, so you have the two different, you have the M equal 1, M equal 0. So you can split the two in the calculation and see. And it really, only for the M equal 0, where you have something on axis, where you will see these rescattered electrons. But it's a new toy to play with, something to have fun with. Also for the other delay, where you don't have the streaking, you start to see an asymmetry. This is now the delay where there is no net momentum transfer to the electron. And I just use a wave packet in the continuum, I crank up the intensity, and I start to see when, as we approach this one for the gamma twiddle parameter, well, we start to get asymmetric. This is, of course, the deformation of the Coulomb potential when we drive electron into the wall, so to speak. It's not a sharp line, but you will never have a sharp line. But I think it's rather convincing. I don't know what you think. That's up to you. And last, I want to show what it looks like with one pulse instead, because this is rather interesting. This is now helium instead of argon. I drive the wave packet back, and all of a sudden we get all these interferences again. This is, of course, the drift velocity is zero, but the field is very strong, so we drive the electron back and forth around the core, and it rescatters many times. So the spacing between these interferences is just the one omega spacing you could expect from multiple events. And in the calculation, we can remove the atomic potential when the electron is moving around, and we see that these jets are gone and there is no interference at all. It's just a shifted wave packet. And this is that I like to conclude, to summarize. I hope I've shown you, convinced you that it is possible to generate this new type of attosecond pulses, that is, which is a train with one pulse per IR cycle, and just adding the second harmonic. It's a nice control knob. You get more control over the process. These trains can then be used to initiate wave packets, and using an IR field, we can control them. It's, of course, a trivial first step. We look at an electron motion in an electric field, but that's, we have to start somewhere to make the movies. And this is a new way to initiate strong field processes, which could be interesting for some applications. With that, thank you.
Maybe I missed the point, but this 3D wave packet control, what do you remind me what you have in mind there?
I mean, at first, of course, it's a way to measure the attosecond pulses. I mean, that's the first take. The other thing is that, okay, we are in these electrons, they don't have 90 electron volt. I mean, they don't leave the potential quickly. I mean, we are close to, I mean, we have time to interact with the core, with the field. So they are in a regime where we expect to see more effects of the electron ion core interaction and the field. And it's, as I said before, it's just, I mean, this is what most of the experiments are based on, the fact that this picture is right. So it's just one, it's a nice verification of that.
So when the streaking field is low, you start and have setback, like what you...
Yeah, you don't really see the sideband in this case, since you have both odd and even harmonics. The sidebands have this, I mean, they will be offset by one photon, and the spacing between your peaks is one photon, so you just start to move things around. But
you also did this same element for, like, just IR only, right?
Yes, yeah, and then you...
You said sideband and also streaking at the same time?
No, I mean, you see either. That depends on the IR intensity. If you have a low IR intensity, you only need 10 to 11 watts per square centimeter, you start to see side vents, and then you crank up the intensity, and you start to see the streaking.
So when does that set back disappear?
They don't disappear. It's just that you get a lot of higher order side vents as well. And then all these peaks will interfere. I mean, you can actually calculate this just by adding up a sufficient number of Bessel function, and you get the streaking. So there is, I mean, there is no magic transition. It's just the side vents will get stronger and stronger. Eventually, they will have the same strength as the other peaks, and you will start to see very high order side vents. And eventually, it is the streaking. It's a gradual change from side vent to streaking.
So would you say that your conclusion about the new regime for strong field physics suggests that the best way to do these kinds of strong field scattering problems and peaking problems would be to separate the problem of what produces the quantum motor potential to what produces the electron wave packet? You want to use an attosecond pulse produce the electron wave packet, but it seems like you're really kind of driving us towards longer wavelengths so that we can avoid field ionization sacrificing the quantum motor potential that we need to get into what you're calling the strong, the new strong field regime.
Yes. And if Liu were here, he'd be happy.
Well, because also the other thing that's driving to that rate is you want to make the wave packets near threshold. So
why?
Well,
that I don't get from the strong field regime.
No, I mean, it is in order to drive it back to the core. If you start with a high initial kinetic energy, you need more IR intensity to drive it back.
Okay. But I also see that maybe it isn't in your strong field regime parameter. But I also know that we need to have sufficient momentum in the electron to be able to get the resolution for imaging.
Yeah.
So we can't do this with 5 dB electrons, but we can do it with 100 dB electrons, no problem.
Okay.
So I don't think we're going to get around that.
No. But it is, I mean, as Ken said, I mean, we separate the ionization process from the driving process, which is nice. It gives us a new knob. I mean, we're experimentalists, we like to have a knob to tune. And this way, even though we can't drive the electrons back as hard as you would like to with 100 kV, we can drive them back. And just by changing the time delay between these two, we change the energy with which energy the electron comes back. And maybe, I mean, it's not the solution to everything, but there are definitely a few applications where this would be interesting.
I could also conjecture that although we separate those two steps right now and we say we'd like to keep the direct ATI low in the background, if you really understood what was going on, it could be cool to have two wave packets in two different ways, equally strong, interacting if you knew what was.
Sure, but we're going to run into the problem pretty soon that the interesting systems to look at have reasonably low ionization potentials.
Right.
And so you got to avoid blowing them up before you get a chance to know that's right.
Why is that? Why should you have reasonably low ionization potential?
Why? Because once you get 4 or 5 atoms together and there are different kinds of atoms. I mean, I don't know of an example where the ionization potential stays up over 20 eV in that case. It always drops down to 10 or below, 5 even. 5 is pretty good for organic chemistry.
Yes,
But when you get larger structures, this is not a solution, I have to say. As we say in Louisiana, I don't have a dog in this fight. I don't expect to be making money off of imagery ever. I don't have a dog in this fight. But it's also true that when you have extended systems, you can get a lot of resonances in the continuum. So I mean, by picking the central frequency, you could pick some other electron out. You might not necessarily. If you add a second pulse, we take it out. just the electron that we would take out of the long wave on the field. So, you know, as a matter of fact, you know that with surfaces, right? That's one of the reasons harmonics are kind of interesting for surfaces, because there's very little oscillator strength in the first QED, right? But you really need to take something, you know, if you look at absorbed surface states, you need to take something to 30 UV before you have a reasonable oscillator strength. So it could also be the same that way, that you would take advantage of structure to make your wave packet kind of preferential. And that is really, that would be interesting. And what I would, you know, want to hear from the other atomic physicists is there a simple system where you can check that? Because I don't know of any simple system that has much interesting structure, you know, that is resonant. I know like Cooperman, I know ways to turn off on the wave.
But the Cooper minima is one electron issue. I mean, just the Cooper minima are just one electron.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm saying that the Cooper minimum is the opposite of what I'm looking for.
No, if you're looking for the sort of thing that exists in iodine and bromine, where you get these gigantic resonances at 50 dB.
That's right. And so I have my 50 dB centrum. I have my train.
It's coming from me and electrons.
Yeah. Sure, but it's not me. Hey, electrons and electrons. I've heard they're all the same.
now then, okay, let's understand. So now,
John, can you close the door? I think the coffee is
interfering.
Again.
Once again,
missing the coffee. He is the coffee. The string theorists, they're eating our cookie now.
They get more ways than one. They get lots of streams.
So let's say that you have a big enough frequency. Mm-hmm. Let's say you have a big enough frequency, big enough photon, mm-hmm. that comes from an attosecond pulse, to eject, take an overdose, to eject a P, I'm sorry, MS, that's the perception. Okay. That's what. So now you check this, and now you drive that. Mm-hmm. That's the idea, right?
Yes.
Right. Now, then you have an object process taking place, but that's an interesting thing in itself.
Right. And
now,
I would love, and that's, you know, what I talked about in my talk yesterday about saying, you got an interferometer, you've characterized it really well, and now you put something in one of the arms. So that Auger process is the thing you put in the arm. Mm. Right? It's the thing you want to image.
Mm. But now, so if you, so you drive now this electron with the IR.
Yes. It interacts with a system that has either undergone the Auger decay or not.
Mm. Well, yes, depending on what is the frequency. No, but the IR frequency is big enough, you know, but so that gives you a time scale. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that's slow compared to an Auger decay.
They come in today?
It's slow. Isn't it slow? And I want the frequency. Mm-hmm. Let's take a rare gas and remove not the deep electron, say an S electron. So now, what is the, I don't have off the top of my head, the lifetime of that decay?
Ten femtosecond.
Now what is that? That's 1/N IR frequency.
That's 2.7 femtosecond.
So it's about the rhyme. But then you would like.
This is what Ferrand slips, right?
Yeah, but you would like. Wait. But then you mean the
Auger, looking for the Auger decay.
Yeah, that was a B. But they did not.
They saw a 7 femtosecond process.
Yes. Yeah.
But then it's the same ballpark, you're saying, right?
Yeah.
So you would like.
So there are faster processes.
You would like that to be faster than the Auger decay.
Yes.
That's right. So then you would like, instead of NIR,
to drive.
Yeah, okay, so what you're suggesting is that having low frequency has its disadvantages if you're looking at very fast process.
What I was thinking about, maybe we can discuss here for some quite a while, if the time is too long for one optical signal,
yes,
you might polarize your infrared beam, mm-hmm, so you get angular dependent emission on these wavelengths, and so you get information about longer times. You have the short time, so to say, it's one optical signal, but you have the longer times, which is just the polarization of your infrared field, right?
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm.
So one thing I didn't catch in your experiment, you have a very short attosecond pulse, you pre-ionize an electron. Is that it? And then you come with infrared after.
Well, they're both there simultaneously. They co-propagate.
Because we showed in some time, isn't this right, that if you pre-ionize with a very short attosecond pulse, the electron goes out in a particular direction.
Okay.
And the question is, can your infrared pulse now come and pick up? Because the correction to the energy is P0 A of T, right? That's what Anne showed at her talk. Now that P0 can be positive or negative. Sure. Do you see this?
Well, in this case, I mean, that all depends on the IR field. I mean, it's this
right
direction of it. So we drive things up or down. We don't see an effect of the attosecond pulse. It's really the IR field driving either upwards or downwards.
But you don't see the initial momentum of the electron, the direction of the ionized electron.
No, there is. I mean, that's symmetric.
That's their distributions.
Yeah.
Some are going up, some are going down.
Yeah. So without the IR field, we have symmetry.
So you haven't measured the asymmetry.
No. Well, I mean, there is an asymmetry when you add the IR field. But
right. Yeah. IR field tells you there's an asymmetry.
Yeah.
And you can measure that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the movie. I mean, that the asymmetry is moving up and down.
Yeah. Somewhere is right.
Yeah. Okay. Well.
What was the frequency of X in the attosecond pulse?
It's just above the ionization threshold in argon, so
what?
Just above the ionization threshold of argon, so it's
12,
central frequency.
12, 15, maybe something like that. So
yeah.
The ionization of the outer shell.
Yeah. It's just the valence electron. We try to get close because we want the slow electrons.
No, therefore you get an outer electron.
So would there be any advantage to having a third color?
Plasma physicist. More colors.
Maybe, remove more pulses. I don't know. Yeah, you. It's. I mean, with two pulses, two colors, you span a lot of options. You can change the relative intensity, you change the relative phase, and so on. But of course, at first, you get complicated fields. But I don't know what the advantage would be. No, I haven't. I should think of that because I've had that question before. What if you add more?
Two is the first big number.
Three.
Yeah. Three. You said that.
Never works with three. You know the
all right
Atlantic Triangle always becomes chaotic.
Well, I think we're about at the end here. Let's thank Johan. And tomorrow morning, Paul will give his second.